Welcome to episode 9 of the Humane Research Australia podcast. My name is Mika Tran and I am HRA's Media and Communications Officer. For any listeners new to HRA, we are a not-for-profit organisation advocating scientifically valid and humane non-animal methods of research based in Melbourne, Australia. We believe that animal experimentation is outdated, unreliable and causes suffering. The core mission of our organisation is to share resources, communicate and build awareness about this complex issue with nuance and respect for science. Last week we launched a new report titled Optimising Inhalation Research, Transitioning to Human Relevant Science, which examines the use of animals in respiratory research in Australia. In this episode, we'll be interviewing Natalie Anderson, a respiratory research scientist who also works on the HRA team as our science outreach consultant. Natalie is in her final year of her PhD at Curtin University investigating the health effects of e-cigarette aerosols and medical aerosol delivery through artificial airways with computational fluid dynamics. In this podcast episode, she'll be stepping us through the key findings from our report and sharing her insights as a scientist who specialises in this field. Welcome, Natalie.
Hi, Mika. It's lovely to be here.
So firstly, can you start by sharing some contextual background on the field of respiratory research in Australia today? What is the main purpose of this type of research?
Yeah, sure. So respiratory research is necessary because respiratory conditions like chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and lung cancer are amongst the top five leading causes of death in developed countries today. Research in respiratory health is essential to better understand the cause of disease or mechanisms that contribute to respiratory conditions. And then with that understanding, we can create better medications and better therapies to treat them.
Great. So what are some commonly used research methods in inhalation toxicology?
So inhalation studies are commonly used to determine whether or not an inhaled substance is safe to inhale, so and how much of it is safe to inhale, and what effect inhaling that substance has on the respiratory system and on other body systems. And this is to make sure we find out if there's a risk to health from inhaling it. An inhaled substance can be something from the environment, like air pollution, from car exhaust, from bushfire smoke, or from a chemical someone is exposed to at work. Or it can be something someone chooses to inhale, like cigarettes or e-cigarettes. The inhaled substance could also be a potential inhaled medication, and we need to work out what dose is safe to inhale and what dose will properly treat the lung condition. Usually these kind of studies are called acute inhalation toxicity studies or safety studies, and they're done in rats or mice. And the outcome of the toxicity study for the animal would be death from systemic toxicity or organ system failure, which results in death. And the point of these studies historically is to determine what dose of inhaled substance causes 50% of the animals used in that study to die. So it's a simplistic way of deciding whether or not something is safe for humans. And they've done studies these ways for many decades.
Can you tell us a bit more about the use of animals in toxicology research and the rift between basic research and clinical research?
Sure. So I mentioned that the acute inhalation toxicity studies can be used to assess whether or not a potential inhaled medication is safe to inhale and how much of it is necessary to inhale to properly treat the condition. Most often the medication is intended to treat a respiratory condition where the drug takes effect in the lungs, but nowadays there are inhaled vaccines or inhaled medications like insulin. Inhalation is less invasive than injection, so it's increasingly considered as a way to deliver medications. There are over 5,000 diseases, but less than 100 treatments for these diseases, And many current medications treat the symptoms of a disease rather than address the disease cause, for example, inhaled corticosteroids for asthma. The problem the pharmaceutical industry has faced over the past decade at least is that treatments identified as promising in animal studies go into human studies and fail, which is really disappointing and costly. And the studies fail because there is an effect of toxicity that was not observed in the animal studies, or because the medication relieved symptoms in the animal study and did not have that same efficacy in human studies.
So in our report, we focus on two specific methods of inhalation research that uses animals: nose only and whole body. Can you please explain the first one, nose only, and describe what a typical procedure might involve?
Sure. In the report, we focused on both the nose only exposure method and the whole body exposure method. The nose only exposure method is intended to make sure that the mouse or rat is exposed to a big dose of the inhaled substance. To do this, the animal is placed into a small tube so that it can't move, so it can only pop its nose out. And that's to make sure that no aerosol goes into the eyes and everything's inhaled through the nose, to make sure the animal is caused the least harm possible and doesn't die during the experiment. It should be trained beforehand to go into the tube. So you can probably imagine if you were put into a confined space where you couldn't move, and had to stay there for a few hours a day, for a couple of months, you might not like it either. But if you were asked to go in for 10 minutes and then come out and had that time gradually increased up to 2 hours, some people might find that easier. So that's why there's a training process.
So now, can you please explain the second method, whole body, and describe what this method involves?
So whole body exposures, fairly self-explanatory. The rats and mice are placed into some sort of chamber that's filled with aerosol, and the chamber can be big or small. But if you want to do a study quickly, often what's called pie boxes are used. So it's a circular chamber or a pie that's divided up into slices, and one mouse is put in each section, and the sections are usually very small so that the mice can't move. And the aerosol should come in, often comes in through the centre of the pie. So it's supposed to go through mainly through the nose of the animal, as the nose of the mouse is pointed toward the centre of the pie.
Can you please give a brief overview of the key criteria we use to critique these methods in our report?
Sure. So study validity generally has two components, an internal and an external component. So we didn't, in the report, we didn't critique the methods from an animal welfare perspective. We didn't use the the more commonly used today, five domains model to assess the impact of the experiment on the animal. That wasn't the purpose of the report. We were assessing the study validity. So the first component of validity typically involves asking, the first thing is, if I do what I say I'm going to do, can I actually do it? And then the second component of study validity is more broadly, if I do what I say I'm going to do, is what I've found real and not just due to chance? And that's important because, firstly, if you can't do you say you're going to do, then your study might fail or confuse the outcome. And if your findings are not real and due to chance, or the population you were studying was not representative of the true population, then at worst, you've wasted a lot of time, effort, and money. So, and at best, you've learned what not to do next time. So that's why a lot of time is put into the planning stages of the study. And study validity is essentially what makes a result real. If your study is valid, your result is real.
Natalie, can you explain to us the main objective of this report? What was HRA hoping to do with the report?
We weren't focusing on critiquing the animal welfare aspect of the acute inhalation toxicity method use in respiratory research. We were more wanting to see why the acute inhalation toxicity method was being used in respiratory research more broadly. So what types of studies were applying that method, either a nose-only exposure method to inhaled substances or a whole body exposure to inhaled substances. I think strictly speaking, we didn't critique, but we gave an overview of some study design considerations. We gave an overview or some examples of studies that were using both methods.
So can you tell us why study design is a key component of internal validity and what must be considered to adequately design an animal inhalation study?
Sure, so study design is a key criteria because it answers the first question you need to ask to determine whether the study is valid or not. And there are lots of important criteria that should be assessed when designing an inhalation study in animals, but the biggest question, the first question, should be purely maths and physics, so which is how much of the inhaled substance is reaching the lung. So if I am doing a study, I want to know what the inhaled dose is in the milligrams per kilogram body weight of the animal and how much of this dose is expected to reach the lungs, or in other words, how much of the dose gets trapped in the nose, which is a lot for rodents. Over half of the dose can be trapped in the nose. And this question is more difficult than it might sound. So firstly, the aerosol should be characterized. And what this means is we want to know more about it. What size is it? What is it made of? Does it change under certain conditions, like when it's humid or hot? And this is important because an aerosol could be a solid particle or it can be a liquid particle. And usually aerosols are fairly small, which make them difficult to measure. And liquid particles are more difficult to measure than solid particles. So there are all sorts of considerations there, just purely with the physics, the mathematics of the aerosol delivery.
So let's take a look now at the next component of validity. What factors compromise the external validity and translatability when using animal models in this research?
External validity is an interesting question, and the answer is again answered with maths and based in mathematical theory. But this component of validity is basically there to rule out any bias. So, for example, if you specifically chose a certain study population because you knew they had a certain characteristic that improved your study, or if you chose a small population because if you had a larger population, you were less likely to see the results you wanted, or if you did something repetitively, for example, you do an experiment at a certain time of day because you know it might get a certain result, or if you get a certain person to do something because you know the way they do it will produce a certain result. So all of those examples, you've introduced bias, and those are the things that you want to avoid in your study design, so that your results are translatable. And the way that we generally reduce bias is through randomization and blinding in studies. Blinding is important because perhaps the most well-known form of bias is observer bias. And so that's why blinding is so important in clinical trials. You might have heard that randomized controlled trials are the standard, gold standard clinical trial. So, because if a group of people knew that they were getting a certain drug, which the researchers knew were better than the other one, it might affect the study results, and therefore the result would not be a real result.
So you've just spoken to us about internal validity and external validity and the two differences between those components. Could you offer us some insight into what was found in our research report using those components?
So in the report, we identified that there were different lengths of exposure to the inhaled substances. So for example, some of the animals were exposed maybe a few hours a day and others for longer per day, and some were exposed for a few days a week and some were exposed for five days a week. So there are differences in the exposure duration. And whilst that's not a problem internally with the study design, it can limit the transferability of those results just because it makes it harder to compare studies, compare between studies, compare results between studies. So we did observe that.
So through the report, what type of studies did you find were using acute inhalation toxicity method?
Sure. So the finding was that the specifically the nose only acute inhalation toxicity method was used to expose mice chronically for chronic exposure to cigarette smoke, and this was to induce a chronic obstructive pulmonary disease model in the mouse. So that was one, that was the main reason the nose-only exposure method was being used in studies that we found in Australia. The whole body exposure method was used to investigate some disease effects or more broad effects of smoke exposure. So that can be, that was in some of the studies, gastrointestinal dysfunction or emphysema, and also just looking at the systemic or local effects of e-cigarette aerosols as well. So the whole body exposure methods were used for a more broad range of studies.
Okay. So let's talk about the next criteria, animal welfare. How is animal welfare and the ethical implications of using animal models considered in scientific research?
Yeah, the basic principles of animal use in research are guided by the three R's, so replacement, reduction, and refinement, where they're considered important to consider those three R's in that order, so with replacement being the most important, if possible.
So what is HRA's assessment of animal welfare and ethics in regards to this particular method of research?
So as I said, with the report, we didn't investigate any effect of animal welfare we didn't investigate any effect of the methods used on animal welfare, but I believe HRA finds the methods used in acute inhalation toxicity studies to be unethical. From a research perspective, the first assessment for researchers is to consider replacement where possible. And that's why the report focused on identifying the most promising method to replace this acute inhalation toxicity testing method.
And just to elaborate on that, what did the report find?
The report found a previous international report actually that had identified there was there was 284 in vitro or human relevant and non-animal methods that can be used in respiratory research. And I think it was around 24 of those can be used as a replacement to study the disease mechanism of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. So we found, and we specifically found, the most of the literature we found was focused on microphysiological systems. So, and they're also called organ on a chip systems, or increasingly we're seeing body on a chip systems. So those seem to be the most promising methods that can replace animal use in science more broadly, and in respiratory research, the lung on a chip is the most promising to replace certain disease models, and more broadly study lung biology.
So earlier you spoke about the three R's, one of which was replacement. What scientifically valid human relevant approaches are currently being used that have the potential to replace the use of animals?
Sure. So this internationally, there's a huge effort to replace animals in research. There are over 10 centres for alternatives to animal use. So those centres have identified that microphysiological system technologies are those with the greatest potential. As I said, they're also called organ-on-a-chip technology. But essentially, they use human cells and mimic the human physiological and chemical environment. And this can be either a static mimicry, or it can be a dynamic mimicry. So I'll explain that in a minute. But there are organ chip societies and programs internationally that are also working towards a human body on a chip, and that could be used to test potential medications for their safety profile. So I'll just go back to the lung on a chip. A dynamic lung on a chip just means that it has a it can sort of breathe in and out, I suppose, is the best way of saying that. And it has a blood flow, a dynamic flow of blood through the system. So the mechanistic environment of the lung is as important as the chemical environment. And the studies have found that the dynamic lung chips more effectively mimic the lung environment. And there are many models, disease models that have been validated for use with the lung chip. The lung chip models in the microphysiological systems also that have been validated also include smoke-induced COPD, lung cancer, and recently cystic fibrosis. So there's huge potential for these technologies to be further developed and further used in research.
So seeing as these non-animal methods do exist, as you've just explained to us, then can you share perhaps what some of the barriers faced by researchers are in phasing out the use of animals and moving towards these non-animal methods?
So at the 2021 11th World Congress for Alternatives and Animal Use in the Life Sciences, there were five top barriers that were identified. So these were lack of understanding of how advanced human relevant technologies work. The second was status quo bias, which is an emotional bias for the preference of the current state of affairs. As we are humans, we don't like change very much, or we don't like uncertainty, because there's risk with uncertainty. So the third identified barrier was journal editorial policy. And this just refers to the requirement for many editors, or through the reviewer process for publication, that reviewers are asking for studies in animals to validate these in vitro technologies. So that was identified as a barrier. The fourth is the regulatory requirement. So while there's been a lot of progress towards using in vitro human relevant technologies as part of the regulatory requirement for testing of these inhaled medicines, it's not to date, it hasn't been fully replaced by in vitro methodologies. They still require the use of animals. So there has been a lot of progress towards changing that, but as yet there has not been a complete, there certainly hasn't been a complete replacement of the use of animals for testing the safety profile of inhaled medications. And the final barrier was avoiding sunk costs. So sunk costs are just expenditures which can't be reclaimed in any way that are pertaining to the use of animal models in the past. So any time that you've spent optimizing a particular animal model, all that time, you might consider that a sunk cost, or any equipment that you've purchased for the use of animal studies, or it could be even more broadly speaking, the money that's invested in animal resource set our facilities in more broadly speaking. So those were the sort of top five barriers that have been recently identified.
And what are some possible solutions? What are some possible solutions to overcome these barriers?
Yeah, so to I'll sort of start in order, I suppose, of the five barriers and the sort of antidotes, I suppose. But to overcome the lack of understanding of how human relevant technologies work, we need a focus on education and training in alternative methodologies. And it's really important that we establish an alternatives validation centre here in Australia that can allow us to do that, that will give us the funding to focus on the education and training and the base for doing that, I suppose. That's the first one. So the second sort of antidote, the antidote to the second barrier or status quo bias, or that preference for the current state of affairs, is open-mindedness. And this can be achieved by a number of ways, but the two key things that sort of have been identified is that there's a preference. This status quo bias involves a preference for the traditions and the currently held opinions over the scientific evidence. So this is something that, as the scientific evidence builds, it's going to be harder and harder to stick with those old traditions and opinions. So that's one aspect of it, is time that's going to help with this. This open-mindedness is just the pure weight of evidence, which is significant already, but constantly building. And the other component of breaking the status quo bias, I suppose, is really just acknowledging that science is experiencing a revolution towards human relevant in vitro and in silico or computational science. And a paradigm shift is a whole entity of itself. So it involves various stages, and they're complex. It's a complex series of social changes that occurs throughout this paradigm shift. As I've mentioned previously, we've been doing studies in animals for many, many years. Equally, it will take time to shift that paradigm of believing that we need to use animals in research for the research to be sound. And then so the antidote to the third, the journal editorial policy, we actually have a really good example of of this shifting, this bias towards requirement for more animal studies being asked for by reviewers. So Nature Biomedical Engineering Journal employs an editorial process where any reviewer's report can be requested to be published by the submitting authors. So this opens the way for increased transparency and openness of the review process that we have not seen before, really. And that enables researchers submitting to journals, or this particular journal at least for now, a fairer path to publication, and it also places increased justification for requests by reviewers for animal testing as well, when those reviewers' reports can be published. So the antidotes for the fourth barrier, there's a couple, I suppose, really. The fourth barrier is the regulatory requirement for animal testing. So informing the public and the politicians is one sort of way to overcome this. And it's really important, I think, to inform the public. So, for example, in 2018, only 10% of respondents to a National Australian Survey commissioned by Humane Research Australia indicated that the annual animal use in Australia, which is 7 million animals per year, was acceptable. So, and additionally, nearly 70% of the respondents supported allocating public funds into alternatives to animal use. And interestingly, 80% of respondents were unaware that there were alternatives to animal testing and research for human medicines. And this was a survey, a public survey, but a couple of years ago, the NHMRC commissioned a report to investigate the three R's in research, and one of their findings was that we can do better in Australia at identifying new innovation. So that's important too, to know that it's not just the public that doesn't realise there are alternatives. Actually, researchers themselves may not be aware of the innovation going on internationally. So that's important to sort of be aware that we can inform the public better, and then that's going to have an effect, a flow-through effect. It can put more pressure on regulatory agencies and other agencies to make sure that we're doing the best we can to replace animal use in research and testing. The fifth barrier is the desire to avoid sunk costs. And this can sort of be broadly overcome by a redeployment of funds. And funding initiatives are necessary from both government and industry bodies, such as has been seen internationally with various innovative initiatives being funded. And Humane Research Australia has noted in their business case that there's already considerable support from Australian researchers for the provision of funding to develop alternatives. And this is important because there's not been much focus, if any, on funding purely for replacements to animals in research. There has been some funding more broadly focused on the three R's, but never specifically on the first R of replacement, to my knowledge. So it's important that we have this funding. And currently there's a unique opportunity to redivert funds from the proposed Animal Resource Centre closure in Western Australia. So potentially these funds could be diverted into alternatives In the United Kingdom, they have recently, in the last couple of years, announced a closure of their animal genomics research facility. I think that was 2019, and they closed primarily to pursue alternatives. So it seems that we like the UK had years ago, have that opportunity to pursue alternatives. And I just want to say, more broadly speaking, so there are five in the report. We've touched on the five key barriers, and then five key sort of antidotes to these barriers. But there is a lot of overlap. The antidotes sort of apply to all of the barriers in one way or another. So there's sort of a complex system interplay going on. And that's, I suppose, that's important to know.
You know, if there is this this current sort of transition or a shift in this paradigm around the use of animals, can you perhaps just remind us or highlight some of the potential benefits to be gained in using human-based research?
Sure. So the potential gain is ultimately better healthcare for everyone, but also importantly, a better understanding of the human species. We're really pushing the boundaries of what technology can do currently, and this is really fascinating science. So I think it's better for researchers, it's better for patients, it's better for the public. And obviously, the most important thing, it's better for the animals that we leave them out of this.
And so, just in closing, as a respiratory research scientist, what is your hope for the future in regards to this field of research?
I hope that all researchers, not just respiratory researchers, can move in the direction of human-relevant research. It's really important to close that gap we currently have between innovation and academic research. And in my position as a PhD student, I use computational modelling and simulation to investigate respiratory medications. And I think it's really important to know that there's a great benefit to using computer modelling and simulation. You need to be able to program these models. You need to be able to understand in great detail the physics of the system that you are investigating. So it's really important that this mechanistic understanding of the human body is incorporated into all of our research. And I think that's why the dynamic lung chip is so was shown to be more effectively to mimic the human environment, lung environment. So it's really important that we're linking in with the mechanistic understanding as well. And we know from our undergraduate training, I suppose, in human biology, that there's a direct link between structure and function. But then you get into a research area and it sort of becomes very you become very specialized, so it's important to go back to those basics as well of our understanding of the human body. And I think the greater understanding that we have of the human body can lead us to these better treatments and hopefully ultimately to prevention of disease in the human species.
Thank you so much for speaking with us today, Natalie, and for taking us through our inhalation studies report and more broadly discussing the transition away from the use of animal models to more human relevant methods of research. It's been great chatting to you.
Yeah, thanks very much, Mika. Thanks for having me on.
In conjunction with this report, HRA have launched our Force to Smoke campaign, calling for Australian universities and research institutes to stop using the forced inhalation studies in favour of scientifically valid, non-animal, human-relevant research methods, such as in vitro methods, which we learned about in today's episode. For listeners who want to learn more about this research, support our campaign to stop forcing animals to smoke, or read our full report titled Optimizing Inhalation Research, Transitioning to Human Relevant Science, you can do so at our campaign webpage, www.humaneresearch.org.au/forced-to-smoke/. That's /FORCED-TO-SMOKE/. Individual links are also shared in the episode notes of this podcast, along with our social media handles. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and LinkedIn. That's it for this episode. Thank you all for listening.